The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
We're inseparable from the world of fiat currency. The banking system, anywhere you go in the world, is an entangling alliance. If you want to transact, you must bank. There's nothing wrong with the deposit and savings function of those institutions. The weakness comes from the currency and the dependency on a home currency. Pick a reliable one.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. I got a text from you Friday night that reminded me of my grandpa. My grandfather was cutting hair as a barber in Shamrock, Texas back almost 100 years ago. In fact, his barber chair is still in a museum there in Little Shamrock, Texas on Route 66. But he used to charge 50 cents for a haircut. He'd shave you. You know, 50 cents would take care of the whole thing. And I think 50 cents would also buy a bathtub full of hot water. But, you know, those were the days when a haircut was only 50 cents. But really, what your text showed me on Friday night, that things haven't changed much for the person who operates in gold.
When I was in college, my roommate was teaching me how to play guitar, and he showed me a few basic chords. He was a professional musician, and he said, to keep the rhythm, just remember this phrase, buzz and a haircut, two bits, as you're strumming the guitar. So,
My grandfather used to do that same thing.
Well, so I went for a haircut on Friday, and I found, to my surprise, a conversation on Carl Menger.
Right.
One of the founders
Austrian school.
Exactly.
Right.
We talked about cryptocurrencies. We talked about gold.
And this is your barber.
Well, I'd never been to this barber before. So this young man, he's raising the fifth generation in his family here in Durango, just returning from a 15-year spell or stint in Austin, Texas, and pretty well versed in monetary theory, both kind of the older versions and the new versions with his interest in cryptocurrencies. As the conversation went on, I talked a little bit about what I do. He asked, and so I answered, and the topic of our vaulted offering came up. And we
so the gold vaulted account, yeah, came up.
And in the midst of that conversation, he said, can you pay me today from your vaulted account, from your gold holdings at the Royal Canadian Mint?
So he's basically asking for gold in payment for a haircut.
And I replied, yeah. And so I did. So, you know, $30 and $6 tip. So that's $36 of gold today, which pencils out roughly to 50 cents, which I would have paid roughly that for a haircut 100 years ago.
Yeah, with my grandfather. It's amazing. Okay. If you take gold, which, you know, think about this, an old $20 gold piece. This is after I got the text on Friday night. I was with my son and he said, you know, I wonder if that's about what a haircut was 100 years ago.
It hasn't changed.
And so I got the calculator out and I divided 1320 gold by 20 because, you know, it used to be $20 an ounce. Now it's over 1300 an ounce. Gold's risen about 65, 66 times since my grandfather was cutting hair about 100 years ago. And if you take that 50 cents and take that by 60 to 66 times, that's exactly what you paid for your haircut. So haircuts are the exact same price, Dave, as they were 100 years ago if you had kept your money in gold. Otherwise, you're paying 66 times more.
Right. So some things are constant, more or less, and some things are rapidly changing. And this is the difference between real money terms, where the haircut is still the haircut.
Right.
It is what it is. But in real money terms, the dollar is no longer the same dollar. So even if we fail to recognize the change for what it is in the present tense, the US dollar is not the measure of all things. And you might even say it's not a reliable measure of anything.
Right.
We tend to make little of the inflation target that we have today. It's very harmless. It's only 2%. We tend to make little of the debt that we accrue daily, at least that our government does, as big and as incomprehensible as it is, now $22 trillion or more. And we make little of the discussion between politicians amongst themselves about how they're going to spend money on this or that, even if they don't have the money to spend, again, sort of deficit spending, as if that was an acceptable, as if that was a sustainable approach to governance.
Well, you know, last week I told a story that a man had approached me in church and asked if we were ever planning on paying the $22 trillion in debt off. And actually, we are paying that debt off out of our pockets. The reason, it's not so much that gold has gone up 66 times over the last 100 years. It's that the dollar's gone down that much.
And it takes that many more dollars to buy the same amount. So, yeah, it's not the price of a haircut either that's increased 66 times over 100 years. It's the value of the dollar, which has declined proportionally. So if you look at it from that standpoint, for the man paying in gold, it doesn't matter.
Right.
It doesn't matter. The cost is the same or close enough. And so here I am getting my haircut, and I was gratified. I was very satisfied that the vaulted program came to life as I've desired it to. It's reliable savings. That's its primary role. Reliable savings for all without the risks inherent to the banking system.
Well, but you can't eat gold. How many times do we hear that, Dave? You can't eat gold.
No, it's true. And that's the objection that some people have. But you can't eat cash, and you can't eat credit cards or debit cards either.
Right.
But you can transact. At least I did. I did with the barber. And I think what I'd like to do as time goes on is refine this process of how do we use it for the purpose of not only savings, but transacting. Because, you know, if somebody's ever taken delivery of an ounce of gold or a kilo bar of gold or a 100-ounce silver bar or whatnot, you look at it and you go, how do I transact with this? Well, actually, using the digital trade, it is very easy. I sent him a gift card. I sent him a gift card direct from my account, and all he has to do is open an account at Vaulted, redeem it. He can buy gold at the current price. And so we did it on terms that the government through the years and since 71 has conveniently rejected. We took money back, so to say. And his work as a barber, his work is valued on those terms as it always has been. And I think we need to remember this. We should never forget that when a currency is devalued, so is the work of every person.
Let's look at that, because a man, no matter how much the Federal Reserve wants to print or the Treasury wants to go into debt, a man's hours are still the same as they were 100 years ago. If we were to look at the economy of our life, we don't get to inflate our minutes that we live.
No. So to me, inflation is inherently undignified and insulting, even if inflation is expedient for those that use it and tend to abuse it.
One of the things that I was explaining to this same gentleman was, if we earned interest greater than the inflation rate, then we actually could get ahead. Okay, so let's say that we had 2% inflation, but we could earn 4 on our money. Even with tax, we'd be getting a little bit ahead. The problem is financial repression is the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, the central banks all know that they cannot pay the interest that the inflation rate is, so they pay just a little less, even to the point of zero.
You remember, we talked to the California economist, an academic, Mr. Taylor, who they named the Taylor Rule after.
Right.
And he created this process by which you can figure out where interest rates should be. This is the Taylor Rule.
Which was always a little above inflation.
Yeah. And so if you look at the Taylor Rule today, we are behind the curve. We're not at, and we're not above, we're behind the curve. Interest rates are lower than where they should be. And that does have a real cost. That has a real cost for savers. That has a real cost for depositors in the bank. People are being undercompensated for the risk that they're taking, not only in the banking system, but as it pertains to inflation risk.
It's not that we're even getting a positive rate. There's a lot of debt out there that's actually negative to zero at this point.
Jim Grant, in his most recent letter, looks at the $11 trillion in debt, which is a global stock of debt. $11 trillion, which yields less than zero. That's 22.6% of the debt outstanding around the world has an interest rate smaller than the number zero.
Dave, so, are we going insane? I mean, if I was a kid and somebody said, put money in the bank so that you can get negative rates and so that you can get less out than what you put in, what in the world is the motivation?
Well, it begins to change the nature of the market, because as global debt grows, what you have is interest rates, which now are failing to carry a message. And the message implicit to an interest rate and to the borrower of that money is that there is a cost to borrow, and that there is a risk with having too much of this debt. You know, so what we have now is old ideas about the state assigning value to currency and being able to create it in infinite amounts, both in terms of the currency itself and in debt itself, to pay bills and finance government spending. These ideas are resurfacing. We've talked about modern monetary theory, and the argument goes amongst the modern monetary theory crowd that deficits are zero concern. You don't have to worry about running big deficits when the government controls the printing press.
Yeah.
And so the Fed prints, they simply hand it over to the Treasury to take care of the business of paying for things. And granted, if you look at that, there's a simplicity to it, an elegance, but there's also an insanity to it that chooses a limited time slice, this present time slice, as evidence that no evils will come from the printing press or from a ballooning budget deficit. And what I mean by evils is damage done to the financial system, damage done to investors, damage done to savers, those living on a fixed income. And again, this is not really in direct support of modern monetary theory, but you've got the contemporary monetary policy choices, the folks at the Federal Reserve and other central bankers, and they're justifying themselves.
Yes.
San Francisco Fed wrote a report. Again, Grant points this out. The report dealt with this question. How much could negative rates have helped the post-2008 recovery? And the argument there is that it would have helped a lot. They're arguing that one of the things that we weren't aggressive enough with was getting negative enough. And again, if you listen to that, they're telling you ahead of time what they're going to do again. And in the not too distant future, as they move towards QE, one of the things that you can count on is that rates go negative. Now, I don't know how this works exactly with the market judging where the risk in terms of inflation and the risk in terms of default, how that is priced into the bond market. But I think insofar as the Fed and the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan are trying to play with specific set numbers, we're talking about the Fed funds numbers, they're going to try to batter them down into the negative territory again.
What's amazing to me in these conversations, when they're asking themselves, well, gosh, would negative rates have worked in the 2008 post-recovery? Funny that the conversation doesn't include the saver. Okay, the saver, I was talking to some clients yesterday, Dave, and they had, you know, they had a reasonable amount of money in savings. It was less than $500,000. And they asked me, they said, are we going to be able to retire? They were in their early 60s. Are we going to be able to retire and live off of the interest of our money? The truth of the matter is, years ago, yes. When they could get interest, yes. Today, no. I just told them, stay healthy, keep doing what you're doing, because they do not have enough money to live on the interest on their money. Why? Because the saver hasn't been asked in this conversation.
That's right. The magic 5% is gone. So if you saved $1 million and earned 5% on it, you were never eating into your seed capital. But you had an extra $50,000 added to Social Security. And if you were debt free by the time you were retired, making $60,000, $80,000, $90,000, you could live off of that.
Right.
Yeah, certainly. And in retirement, live pretty well without any debt encumbrance.
Well, but they have tried these socialist types of maneuvers over in Europe, and they seem to, and I keep saying they because it's the elite, they seem to tell us that, gosh, we should do this too because it worked.
Well, in this case, it's the academic elite. It's the central banking elite. It wouldn't be the first time that we've had inflation. And again, these are monetary policy tools, inflation, financial repression, which we're describing with low rates.
Right.
Would be the first time that these have been used to resolve debt issues, right? So we had the experiment with Europe. We had this experiment in Scandinavia, still do. The problem is this, not having blown up the world, right? Merely, and I say that tongue in cheek, merely destroying the price mechanism in the world. Economists are feeling pretty bold right now.
Right.
And they're promoting inherently inflationary policies. You look at the structure of the debt, and it's very favorable, and it will continue to be very favorable for the current borrower. But economists have long held this assumption that there's a rational element underscoring the decision-making of economic participants. This is the study of economics. It's the study of choice, and it assumes a certain rationality. And they seem to have forgotten that excess money and excess credit promote not rational decision-making, but irrational exuberance. Not rational risk-taking, but irrational risk-taking, where all of a sudden the measure of success is lowered, the bar to success is lowered when free capital is being thrown around. It's being subsidized. Risk is being subsidized by a below-market rate, that is the rate of interest. And ultimately, the possibility of a very rational choice does emerge, and that's a possibility that most economists don't consider. It's the possibility of opting out of a system that's rigged and managed from the top down.
Right.
So the economy based on an ever-increasing quantity of dollars and debt, what is it today? it's a great game. It's a big game, and some would call it a confidence game.
Which is shortened to con game. That's where con game came from,
confidence game. That's right. Yeah. What traders recognize, traders in the marketplace recognize that you don't invest in the stock market today. You don't invest in negative yielding paper. You trade it. You speculate in it.
Hoping that rates go more negative and the bond value goes higher.
That's right. So yeah. the value equation has been substituted with a game of odds and a speculation. And in this era, the game has not ended, right? So the academic voices, because the game has not ended and not ended terribly, they've begun to justify the recent policies as a starting point for a new version of Keynesian demand management.
Right.
I mean, think of this. This is important because if Keynesianism works in a crisis, so the current thinking goes, why not allow government deficit spending as an economic pillar in normal times too?
Right.
And that's, if you look at what has happened over the last 10 years, we went from being on a crisis footing to now we're supposed to be in a healthy place from an economic standpoint, and yet we're continuing to deficit spend as if we're in the throes of crisis.
It's a painkiller addiction. When I had the operation on my eye, I started getting to like the painkiller that they were giving me. And I remember reasoning with my ophthalmologist, saying, you know, I think I might need just half a dose more, if you don't mind. And he looked at me knowingly, and he was like, no, that was really just for the surgery. You'll be fine. Because it's human nature. You know, it's the same thing when a doctor gives someone morphine right after a major accident. It's because it's an emergency. The only other time a doctor's going to administer morphine is right before a soldier dies on the field. That's what this is. This quantitative easing, these negative rates, this is an emergency morphine procedure that's been continued, and it's turned into addiction.
Yeah, so now we've got this debt addiction. What is supposed to be a robust economy. I ask the question, why do you need $1.3 trillion extra dollars to operate
robust,
if you have a robust economy?
Right.
Because that's the Treasury was forced to issue $1.336 trillion last year, 2008, to fund its operations. Because there wasn't enough money coming in, and this is a robust economy.
Yes.
Right? So what does the deficit spending look like when it's not so robust? Now, that's for another conversation. But, you know, this is the current administration. Just like the one that preceded it, they see no trouble. They see no trouble in spending what they don't have. And the problems with this approach, I think they're lost on the average stock investor. Because most stock investors are saying to themselves, well, how can I make money? How can I make money?
Right.
And they're distracted by the allure of speculative short-term trading profits.
Well, and they know the morphine is coming. All they have to do is hit the button one more time.
And frankly, the long-term doesn't exist for them. They've pushed it out of their consciousness,
right,
both the long-term in terms of the past and the long-term in terms of the present, leading to this future, which they don't really care about. And so in our portfolio management meetings the last 2 weeks, last week and this week both, I think an interesting observation came out and I wanted to share it with you. We've had the march higher in the equity indexes since early January. And if you look at any of the charts, whether it's the mid-cap stocks or the biotech stocks or NASDAQ, let alone the S&P 500 or the Dow, you look at the chart and the steepness of that climb is completely abnormal.
Back in the game. They hit the button.
Yeah. And so I think what is fascinating is not the steepness of that march higher, but if you look at the yields on German treasuries, if you look at the yields on Japanese government bonds, if you look at the yields on U.S. treasuries, in the last 6, 8, 9 weeks of relentless ascent higher, the treasury yields in these three jurisdictions have hardly budged.
So the bond guys are basically not playing.
Right. So if you look at the stress that we had in the fourth quarter within the financial markets, it got the attention of the bond community. And they're not buying the current hype in the equity markets.
Yeah.
There's a lingering concern and still a very risk-off mode within the bond community that stands in sharp contrast to your equity speculators and your equity players who are, they're risk-on. They're in that mode at present. And, you know, I think it's always important to recall that the bond investor is generally regarded as the more sober-minded, perhaps even the more intelligent of the two. But again, The bond market is sending a very different signal than the equity markets, and then just stack that up with the IQ associated with who's making which bets. My guess is that there's going to be some pain and suffering.
We were talking about homeschooling the other day and how there are life lessons. When you live a deliberate life and you are teaching your kids as you go, and I know you're very deliberate with your kids, when you're doing that, you can actually teach or codify the important things in life. Okay, you can basically, and I remember hearing this when I was a kid, money doesn't grow on trees. Well, our government doesn't behave that way. The code of what you borrow, you pay back. I was talking to a client yesterday and she said, you know, I was raised that way. When I borrowed, I always knew that I would pay it back, even if I missed a meal to pay my debt. That's not what we're showing our kids as far as what the government does. Like you were saying, $1.3 trillion extra dollars to operate, yet we still come out and say, oh, it's a robust economy and there's more of this to come.
Yeah, so the code that you're describing, you know, we used to have this sense of moral obligation to the obligations, the things that we obligated ourselves to.
Right.
And there was a moral component to it, right? Now, instead of moral obligation, we have moral hazard because we've found ways out. Mm. And with a way out, there's a leniency in our approach to those obligations. So go back in time if you wanted to start with the Code of Hammurabi or the Ten Commandments and move through the development of Roman law and British common law.
Magna Carta, yeah.
These are formal rules. There's informal expectations that we associate with particular time periods. And again, sort of the code, if you will. The Victorian era was a classic example. But the code that we have to keep in mind today is a different code altogether. It's summarized in chapters. It's chapter 7, it's chapter 9, it's chapter 11.
You're talking bankruptcy.
Right?
That's the code.
Yeah.
Just the expectation of bankruptcy.
It's the room that one needs to wiggle out of onerous debt. It's what ultimately can create moral hazard. It's the new code we live by, and we have a poster boy for it. Happens to be the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So the new code prioritizes the present moment and growth at the expense of the future on the mistaken belief that the debt burdens left for those either young or yet born can be pragmatically managed the same way as debt in the present tense. The phrase that's used oftentimes in debt circles is evergreening. Mm. Evergreening is what they call refinancing on an indefinite basis. Debt comes due, you roll it over. Debt comes due, you roll it over. Because you don't have the money to pay it back, and you still have more needs to finance current expenditures.
Dave, I was looking at a definition of addiction. I'm reading a book on how addicting Facebook and some of the social media is, and they had just a basic definition of addiction in there, and I think it applies to what you're talking about, where you're more concerned with the present than the future ramifications. Let me just read this to you. It's short. Addiction is a condition in which a person engages in the use of a substance or in a behavior for which the rewarding effects provide a compelling incentive to repeatedly pursue the behavior despite detrimental consequences in the future. That's addiction. Okay, the future is nowhere to be found. The present is the only thing that we care about. And I think about that, and I hope I don't offend some listeners who are smokers, but when it gets to be 5 degrees or 10 degrees below zero, and I drive past, say, Walmart or one of the stores where people are taking a break and they're smoking, they're standing outside
freezing
in -5 degree weather because of an addiction. It can't be pleasant. But see, that's what happens. And ultimately, some of them will end up dying from that addiction. Debt is just like that.
Well, and we've gotten to the point where debt is so large. This is fascinating to me that economists still struggle with how we have tepid growth rates and how, you know, the official rate of inflation, we can talk about the legitimacy of that some of the time, but how the official rate of inflation is still so low. We're not hitting our target of 2%. And what they're really saying is that there's not enough economic activity to keep up with, and I think this is the element that they're ignoring, to keep up with what it takes to maintain the debt obligations, both interest and principal, and what it takes to maintain the value of those assets and keep them functional, keep them with a positive present value.
Last week, you had pointed out that China decided to open up the wallet again and just come out with almost $700 billion worth of credit infused. I looked at that chart in Grant's letter. We talked about that yesterday. And it's just a straight up line of how much credit China has come up with. Why? Because of that tepid growth. The tepid growth that you're talking about, they couldn't handle. They knew politically they have to keep this robust, let's use that same word, this robust growth story going. And they're doing it with debt.
And the hope is that if you put that debt, if you put that credit into the system, it'll create economic activity. So, you know, it was 685, 687, something like that, billion U.S. dollars that was released into the economy in China in January. 447 billion of that was direct bank lending. And again, this is not merely a U.S. domestic issue of being cavalier with mass quantities of debt. It's different than Havenstein's conception of liquidity creation. If you remember, Havenstein was the central banker responsible for
the German hyperinflation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And he had ideas which justified the need for more liquidity being created and put in the system.
Well, he had an excuse, though. The Versailles Treaty, they said that Germany couldn't have existed unless they came up with an economic plan. And so he had an excuse at the time to at least try the experiment. They were in a crisis.
Well, and I think he looked at the increasing cost and he had cause and effect confused. And he said, look, we've got increasing costs for goods and services. People need more money to be able to pay their bills.
Let's just print it.
And to allow the gears of the economy to move more easily. So we will increase liquidity and ease the strain of a money scarcity problem because of the increase of costs. We have a money scarcity problem. And he didn't realize that as he created more money, he was adding to the flames of inflation.
He had not read about John Law.
Well, and I, again, there's no excuse like the Versailles Treaty's onerous payments today. You know, and yes, they were forcing the central bank to figure out ways to finance those payments and then ultimately inflate the system. That was a part of Haverstein's problem. And you don't have that today. What you have instead is a very critical concept that we discussed with Tomáš Sedláček, which is this being enraptured with the idea of infinite growth and how it's actually a very dangerous concept. Everyone loves the idea of growth, but no one really asks at what price and how much is enough. There's a desire to grow and embrace a world of limitless growth where all of a sudden whatever ends are necessary are justified as long as the means and the objectives are met. And so this is where the long-term costs of growth are irrelevant. All that's focused on is the present tense, right? And so the future is discounted proportionally to the short-term benefits created by limitless quantities of money and credit. Because as you know, credit is the new money.
Sedláček talked about that as being a false religion. The false religion of continual growth doesn't work anywhere else in nature. Could you imagine if you were awake all the time and never slept? Could you imagine if we never had fall or winter before spring and summer? Continual growth. But, you know, thinking about it, when Tomáš Sedláček is talking about this, he said it was a false religion and the central bankers are actually the high priests of this false religion. But it's debt, Dave. You have to continually grow once you go into debt. I've learned this in the past when I was young. When I went too far into debt, I had to continue to make more and more money because the debt was costing more and more. So this religion is fomented by living in a deficit society.
Well, I just want to say there is maybe an exception within nature to infinite growth, and it's the crocodile.
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, yeah. If the crocodile is the last of the great dinosaurs alive, it's said that a crocodile never stops growing. Huh. And it's believed that some of the great dinosaurs of old were of very old age, and they had the same genetic predisposition to continue growth throughout their life.
I've heard that about people's noses, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, this comes to mind because the boys insisted that I read the chapter on crocodile deaths from Death in the Tall Grass. They love this kind of stuff. I don't know where they get this morbid sense.
Oh, it must
sense
be from their dad.
Yeah. No, it's definitely not. No, but the reality is we're all Keynesians now.
Right.
We're all Keynesians now, and the Keynesian demand management is not for the exclusive times of crisis, it's for all times, right? The more extreme expressions of this hyper-Keynesianism is promoted by the modern monetary theory group.
Right.
And, you know, what it does is it distracts from the reality that our current monetary backdrop is highly experimental.
Right.
And when you look at it in a very short, condensed period of time and focus only on the present benefit, again, you lose the backdrop. You forget that this is very experimental and in all likelihood will prove to be highly detrimental in the long run. Who cares about what happens in the long run? I mean, anyone who cares about something, someone beyond themselves, perhaps that is the person who cares about the long run.
Right.
But, you know, we're not dinosaurs. We're not crocodiles. We live a short period of life, and all we want is the good life right here, right now.
What's pressing the button? It's the morphine button over and over, but the problem is that'll kill you.
Well, and I think rarer by the day is the person who is legacy-minded, who cares about the actions of the moment and what it means for the future, not just in the present moment, and is concerned about what may be foisted on future generations by the decision-makers in the present moment.
Let's just look at modern monetary theory just for a second before we move on, Dave, because in a way, they're calling our disingenuous methods out. These modern monetary theory people are really, they're socialists, and it's beyond socialism. It's money grows on trees, so you may as well just print it. But what they want to do is actually calling the guys on Wall Street for what they're already doing, because you've got the Federal Reserve, okay, who is giving money to the Treasury, but they're using Wall Street to do it, okay? So the guys on Wall Street are getting fat in the interim. They're the middle guys. All the MMT people are doing is they're saying, you know what, take Wall Street out of the equation. Let's just call it what it is. You're drinking from the bottle. Stop saying you're drinking from a glass slowly. You're drinking from the bottle at this point. Let's just throw the glass out. The glass is Wall Street. You see what I'm saying?
Well, absolutely. And so the inflationary consequences of monetary and credit expansion get focused in on Wall Street because they get to handle the flow.
Right.
They get to touch it before it goes into paying the bills in that process.
Just call it what it is. It's the Fed giving the Treasury money.
Right. My guess is, however, that you'd see less inflation of assets and more inflation of goods and services if the MMT people get what they want, which is, again, a direct hit, a direct flow of money from the Federal Reserve to the Treasury to pay bills and to do so even if it means running massive deficits.
This is exactly what the South Americans, especially the Venezuelans, have found out recently.
Dinner last night, I was sharing some current events highlights. So occasionally we'll do this. And Venezuela and the contradiction of poverty in that country set aside the country having the greatest oil reserves on earth.
It's a rich country.
Oh, it should be.
As far as reserves.
It should be. Yeah, so in-ground resources, they're very rich.
But the people are starving.
And that's where you see that ideas have consequences. So for us as a family to talk about socialism and see what the consequences are of an ideology, they have a third more in reserves at a minimum than Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
And it should not surprise us that our foreign policy target is very much on the Venezuelan government right now. As we partner, and granted this is on a unified basis with other leaders around the world, we want Maduro out. And it remains to be seen who will be in on a long-term basis.
We definitely want access to their oil.
Well, this is the point, isn't it? We've never done anything on a very, very generous basis. There's places in the world that have had problems, and we've ignored those problems for decades. And there's places with much smaller problems that we give sharp attention to, and it really does deal with the bottom line. If you look at the decline rates in the shale oil fields here in the United States, even though we have healthy production today, I think it's no surprise that when we think of tomorrow, at least from a strategic oil perspective, that we're very interested in Venezuela. Anyways, Venezuela was one of the topics of conversation, ideas having consequences, and this weird thing of abject poverty in a country that has tremendous amounts of wealth and potential cash flow. Then we talked also about the $22 trillion in debt that we've accrued. Yeah, $1 trillion from George Washington through the time frame when Jimmy Carter was in office. Another trillion plus, a little bit more than that, when Ronald Reagan was in office. And then 11 times that amount since I was a boy, and you had Nancy and Ronald fighting both the drug war domestically and Star Wars with the Russians in an arms race that ultimately bankrupted the Soviet Union.
Right.
What was that trade? If you put it in terms of a trade, what was Ronald Reagan making a bet on? It was a speculative trade, and it was that we had deeper pockets. We had larger credit lines.
And he was right.
We did.
Yeah, we did.
We won.
Yeah.
But here's one of the things that transformed through the 70s and 80s. Now everything is a speculative trade. Everything is a speculative trade. From the 80s to the present, we spent what we had, and we spent what we wish we had, knowing that credit would flow. So we have in this new financial physics the assumption of unlimited credit.
Right. We haven't had to pay the price, at least visually. We're doing it slowly through inflation, but we haven't really seen this crash of debt that we keep talking about.
So my 10-year-old interrupts me as I'm talking about $22 trillion in debt, and he says, "This is why I prefer to save in silver."
There's that deliberate education there, Dave.
Yeah. You know, education may... Some may accuse me of indoctrination. We'll see. But Bill Dudley from the New York Fed pointed out last week that sovereign debt is much more manageable today. And so again, this is just kind of the attitude. I don't want to say it's cavalier. It's very studied. There's numbers to support and justify this. But who cares about the $22 trillion and growing number as long as economic growth exceeds our borrowing costs?
But we had some tax cuts. Are we not getting an economic bump, at least from businesses being able to keep a little bit more money?
No, thank God for the tax cuts. And I guess I'm wondering, what will we do in 2019 for an encore? Because the burst of growth that we saw in 2018, late 2017, 2018, from the tax cuts, it's largely run its course. So here we are back to Dudley's comments. If Dudley's right, and we're actually not even hitting that number where economic growth is exceeding our borrowing costs.
Right.
If you factor in inflation, in real terms, we're not hitting that number. Even with that temporary tax cut boost, right? But this is where, you look back in history. In history, you've got serial defaults. You've got debt restructurings, which go beyond the limited period of time that we're looking at, the 1980s to the present. Interest rates have been declining. That has accommodated the increase of debt. Economic growth is variable. Economic growth has always been variable. You can't control it like you control a thermostat. This year we want it at 68 degrees. No, let's make it 72 so you're a little bit more comfortable.
It's not like a crocodile. Okay. Economic growth doesn't happen every day. Growth is the wrong word. Economic growing is part of the cycle after economic shrinking.
Well, that's right. So we assume that we're going to continually compound debt, and we can, and that's going to be matched, and that's going to be offset by continual growth rates in the economy.
Right.
And so listening to Dudley, I'm just thinking to myself, so you're okay with the amount of debt that we have, one thing that is permanent, set against the only thing that supports it, which is variable and can go away or go negative. And how does that work exactly?
Yes, but if people stop spending, we always have, you talked about Keynesians. Okay, the Keynesians not only believe in monetary theory, they also believe in fiscal stimulation. You just go spend government money.
Well, that's the idea that we can smooth the economic cycle. This is borrowed from Keynes, that governments can spend to fill the gap when consumers go on strike, that's during a recession or some sort of economic slowdown. And that assumes that government spending lessens in the good times so that it can again be increased during the bad times.
Right.
And again,
that's the theory.
Dudley seems to have forgotten the permanent fiscal footprint of the crowd in DC. $1.336 trillion is not a small amount to have to borrow in 2018 in the context of a robust economy. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We now have the idea that monetary expansion and debt to GDP ratios, they no longer matter.
Money grows on trees.
Right. So you've got the acronyms here in the public sphere, modern monetary theory, which is saying that's exactly right. That's exactly right. We don't have to worry about debt to GDP ratios. Understand the power that you've always had and release it. And Kevin, we edge closer to the day where either rational choice expresses itself to exit the system. Right. And I think that's what we saw with Ray Dalio and Sam Zell. They're beginning to buy gold in recent months. And I think that gives you some idea of their end game vantage point.
Right.
But so you've got either this rational choice to exit a system which is more frail than people appreciate, or irrational fear, which emerges in response to aberrant behavior within the financial system.
Well, it's panic. It's panic.
That's right.
Panic occurs when something unexpected, you don't see it coming. You're talking about rational exiting the system right now into gold. And you mentioned the bond buyer as well. Bond markets are doing the same thing. They're rationally staying out of the stock market. There are people who are taking cover, including China. I mean, China's been buying all the gold for the last 6-8 years.
Anyone who likes the study of history, of things financial and economic, will know that pain and confusion are things that you do see in the social context. You get Alan Newman telling us about his father who experiences the pain and confusion of the 1929 stock market collapse and is unwilling, based on the shattering of his psychology, to even look at his stock positions for 30 years. Even at that point, he assigns his son to go figure out, hey, yeah, tell me if this is worth anything. So, again, we're talking about the aberrant behavior within the financial system and panic or pain being felt by those who put their faith in that ever-increasing price of assets. And the ever-increasing price of assets is tragically dependent on the continuation of credit flows.
Let's look at fiscal spending, though, for a moment. Let's take China as an example. All right. The whole, if you build it, they will come mentality, because China's been building an awful lot of stuff. And that does allow for an economic bump when the building is occurring. The problem is there are an awful lot of empty apartments at this point in China. I mean, that's an understatement.
Well, and I think it remains to be seen how transformative some of that investment is over time. But it's obvious that they've overbuilt. They've pumped in hundreds of billions of dollars in credit in the month of January, single month.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Well, I mean, if you had 65 million empty apartments, that's more
than a
couple dozen. 65 million.
That would be a sign that says vacancy. You know, here in Durango, the hotels, if they're empty, they say vacancy. There's 65 million vacancies.
Right. How many people live in the Los Angeles Valley? Are we talking maybe 20 million? So three times the entire stretching mass of suburban Los Angeles, more than three times that, every residence empty. 65
neutron bomb,
million
completely empty.
Yeah. Empty apartments. Oh, and then add to that, you've got the largest 25 developers reporting a 34% decline, year-on-year decline in volume of sales in commercial property in the month of January.
I'd call that a downturn.
And so you ask, why did they pump in hundreds of billions of dollars? Well, this is why. You can ask yourself, without a massive infusion of credit, can the prices of those assets stay where they are? Or do prices in a market economy, and I realize they have sort of a hybrid of market slash command and control.
Yeah, but you would think the price would fall.
That's
right. If you have 65 million vacancies, the price should fall.
Are prices going to reflect sales volume at some point?
That's called economics, Dave.
I think it's simplistic,
yeah,
but adequate in terms of a supply and demand model. And that's actually how basic banking and financial problems are. You have too much credit on the front end, and that creates too much supply of some asset. And in this case, it's unused apartments. That supply exceeds demand, and then prices correct and bring balance back to the equation. In this case, though, just like our playbook, more credit is infused, and then more, like the fighting of a tide. And it's an ugly picture, but, you know, not everyone.
Press the little red button, the
right,
little red morphine button. As long as it lasts, you may as well press the button. Okay, but not everybody's thinking this way, Dave. I mean, let's say China is the new thing, and somehow they figure out a way to replace the United States economically. Could all this building actually turn into expansion?
You know, I never want to discount the guy who spent the better part of 5 years as head of Asian operations for Morgan Stanley, Stephen Roach, very critical thinker. He's been on our program multiple times. And when I ask him
a
question, he's very clear in his thinking and his reasoning, very fast on his feet. He, to me, combines the best of sort of an academic with a market trader in terms of blending those perspectives. And he points out that, you know, Chinese investment and savings here in recent years, what have they done? They've built stuff. And maybe it gets used in the short run, maybe it doesn't, but they've built stuff that didn't exist before.
In contrast to what we use the money for, which is just speculating in paper markets?
Well, if you go back to your phrase a few minutes ago, if you build it, they'll come, that seems to be the operative philosophy. Mm. And here in the U.S., Stephen Roach would point out that 85% of our gross savings goes towards replacing a worn out capital stock. So if you're talking about plant and equipment and infrastructure, we're just replacing the old stuff that's broken down. We're not enhancing capacity as the Chinese are.
We're maintaining the old jalopy and they're building new cars.
They're building new stuff, which creates a different picture in terms of productivity and in terms of their ascendancy, in terms of how technology and infrastructure end up moving vast quantities of people who prior to had been stuck in a rural agrarian poor category and are now being introduced into an urbanized and developed setting. So his caution, and I think this is wise, regardless of how you parse it and agree or disagree with him, his caution is to never underestimate the Chinese and to never overestimate yourself. I guess by yourself, I mean the U.S. I think he'd look and say, we have long-term structural issues which we have to deal with as a mature economy. And they have short-term issues, but long-term, a growth trajectory which beats ours, no question. And that's his perspective.
What changes if we get a trade deal with China? That's been in the news continually. What changes for us? What changes for them?
Well, one of the things that changes is Groundhog Day goes away. How many times have you woken up in the last 6 months and it's the same thing? We're this close to a great
trade deal.
It is
like the movie, isn't it? Trade deal with China.
Trade deal with China. Yeah. Today is the new... And so the markets have gone up and up and up every day with the same announcement. And it really has felt like Groundhog Day. Like, we heard this yesterday. This is not an excuse for the stock market to go up another 150 points. And yet, it'll go up 150 points because people are enthusiastic about the trade deal. Buy the rumor, sell the news may, in fact, be what happens when a trade deal is announced.
Yeah, it's funny, Dave, as you were talking about how we hear about this over and over. I remember when the Segway, you remember that machine that it's got the two wheels?
A gyroscopic people mover.
Yeah. The way they advertised it, they didn't tell you what was coming out. They just announced that something was coming, something was coming. They had billboards, everything else. They wouldn't tell you what it was, but they said it would be bigger than the internet. And then it came out, and it was this two-vehicle machine that a lot of times people just fall over on and get hurt. Okay, it never turned into anything. I'm sorry. The Segway, we've segued to other things. The trade deal, I'm wondering if that's the same thing. It'll come with a bump when it does come.
Yeah.
But is it really all that it's made out to?
Roach points out that you're talking about a bilateral trade deal with China. So if you have a bilateral trade deal with one other country, it doesn't resolve what is for us a multilateral trade deficit, which will still exist with over 100 trading partners.
So it's not just China. It's 100 other trading partners.
Yeah. And in his view, our short-term economic boost, you know, this has been the benefit that we've had. This is why, you know, growth rates have improved slightly there in 2018. First quarter doesn't look like it's going to be all that great. But tax cuts have added momentum to, you know, a trade on Wall Street. But that is running its course. It's rapidly slowing. And he contrasts that with China, where in spite of the credit and the banking risks, which you have in China, obviously with the growing stock of debt that's there, you can have a catastrophe, a financial catastrophe. But I think he's looking beyond that, again, looking from one peak to the next and over the valley, and saying that the fundamental foundation for growth still exists in China. So again, if you assume that there is a trough between here and there, there is a reasonable peak on the other side. And he's far more hopeful in terms of the prospects of China than he would be for the U.S., growth rates and all considered.
Let's face it, everything we're talking about is just spitting in the wind if infinite money will continue to work. All right? I mean, the old economics only works if it's economics, not just create money out of thin air. Economics, even the word itself, tells you that you have to sacrifice one thing to get another. That's what economics is. What we're basically saying is you just get another, and you get another, you get another. There is no sacrifice. And so this whole program, I would ask our listeners to stop listening to it, honestly, if indeed infinite money will work forever, because we're just a waste of time.
Modern is the key word. it gives you the sense of newness. And my sense, Kevin, is that this is really not that new. We have seen it before. It's just been called something else. Mm. So to me, if you listen to the choir of proponents for infinite money and credit, whether it's the socialists here in the United States, that's not a criticism, that's self-proclaimed socialists, and set them right alongside the majority of Republicans who never met a dollar they didn't like to spend, or communists overseas. Again, this is in China, where they would say, this is exactly who we are. We are the Chinese Communist Party. Every additional voice added to the global choir of infinite money printing and infinite credit creation is one more reason to stabilize savings, and to stabilize savings in a form and in a format that removes the long-term consequences of too much money and credit.
It sounds like your barber gets it. It sounds like your 10-year-old son gets it.
I paid for a haircut in gold, from savings held in gold, so that the game that's being played on a global scale does not entangle me. Mm. When I think of the words of Washington reiterated by Jefferson, both discouraging entangling alliances, and of course the reference was to foreign powers, but I think there's an application with our modern banking system. We're enmeshed and we're inseparable from the world of fiat currency. The banking system, anywhere you go in the world, is an entangling alliance. If you want to transact, you must bank. There's nothing wrong with the deposit and savings function of those institutions. The weakness comes from the currency and the dependency on a home currency. Pick a reliable one, because the global problem is now that none actually exists in absolute terms. If you're thinking about a currency choice which you would prefer above another, reliability today is only judged on a relative basis, not an absolute basis. So where predictable meets reliable, that's where I am going to be most comfortable. In my world, I'm still paying 50 cents for a haircut. How much are you paying?
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.